Hello, Star Trek fans, and welcome to the Rebinge Deep Space Nine podcast. My name is Kim.
And my name is James.
And we're watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine from the beginning, one episode at a time. Welcome back to the podcast. Today we are on Season 2, Episode 3, entitled The Siege. This episode aired October 10th, 1993.
The final part of the three-parter.
Yes. Before we move into this episode, is there anything you would like to talk about or correct from the previous podcast?
No, it was perfect.
I don't think it was perfect. I did make one mistake that I remember, which is... I kept saying, for some reason, I was really stuck on Miles saying that the attack vessels at the end were going to Bajor, but of course they were coming from Bajor to the station. I don't know how I got that messed up, but when they did the recap at the beginning, they repeated it as coming from Bajor, and I went, that's not what he said, and I went back and I watched it. That's exactly what he said.
Oops. Oops.
Also, though, we haven't finished editing that episode, so maybe we'll cut out my mistake anyway, and now I'm just telling you what happened. And
what mistake? Really, there wasn't a mistake in the episode.
Exactly.
The advantages of editing.
Right. Well, we get our last time on Deep Space Nine from Loxana Troi again.
Great recap.
We show the circle graffiti, Kira asking for the runabout to go rescue Lee Nalis, Kira beating up on a Cardassian, Sisko telling Lee that Bajor doesn't need a man, it needs a symbol, and then the big drama of Jaro introducing Nalis as the liaison to DS9. That was pretty much all from part one, but then we also get Sisko figuring out that the military isn't supporting the provisional government. Drink! And Jaro announcing that he is the Circle. And then we see the evil alliance of Vedic Wynn and Jaro. And we hear about the assault vessels, which are heading toward the station.
They're closing in.
And now the conclusion. We start in Ops, and Sisko is briefing the Starfleet officers about the evacuation orders. Because they are there on invitation from the Bajoran Provisional Government. Drink. That's already two drinks.
Yeah.
Starfleet feels that there is no choice but for them to leave. He walks through the small group of maybe 15 people, saying he knows they have personal links to Bajor, and he gives some examples, like one of the female officers is engaged to a Bajoran. She looks very sad. And he gives a few other things, like somebody's kid was in a science fair or something.
Oh, an award-winning science fair.
Right. Sisko says he's going to stay on the station to make sure the evacuation is conducted properly. Then Miles says, well, someone needs to oversee the inventory process. And Bashir says, packing up his medical supplies could take quite a while. So everyone is muttering as Sisko smiles.
He does give a really good speech, quite inspirational.
He's given a lot of those in these three episodes.
Yes,
and he's still got one more to come.
Yeah, and in the last episode of season one.
Yes, he's been on a speech roll. He says, before you volunteer too quickly, understand what you're getting into. We'll be trying to delay the takeover of the station as long as it takes to expose the Cardassians' involvement in all of this. It won't be easy. Jaro wants our heads. This is your last chance to leave with your families. I don't blame any of you for getting out while you can. Anyone who wants to evacuate is dismissed. Then they all sort of guilt each other into staying. At least that was my read.
Really? I thought the implication here was that Sisko was inspirational and this was their home and they weren't going to leave without a fight.
Sure, that's the Star Trek read. I just think when it's a group of people and they don't want to be the only person who looks like a coward, they all stick together. Like, oh no, we're going to stay.
Okay.
But of course, we don't know any of these people.
Yeah.
They're all, they have no names or lines. We don't know anything about any of them. So sure, they're all going to do what Miles does.
But they all have very impressive hair.
Oh my gosh. There was some really peculiar hair in that group. Yes.
When Sisko's wrapping it up, the woman to the right of him, most impressive hair of the entire group.
Agreed. Yes. Sisko says non-Bajorans won't be safe here, so our children and families have got to evacuate. The Bajorans who worked with us will also want to leave. There's a lot to get done. The assault vessels will be here in less than 5 hours. And he dismisses them. And then we cue the theme song.
One thing that's interesting about this scene is it seems to be slightly at odds with what Neela said from the end of season one, where she talked about how Starfleet and the Bajorans weren't interacting. This sounds like there was an enormous amount of interaction.
Well, it's possible that it changed after the end of the season, right? Because some time had passed.
Yeah, that's true. But I was also wondering, perhaps Neela saw what she wanted to.
Yeah, maybe.
That she was filtering out the contact between the Bajorans and the Starfleet and going, oh, well, they're not really getting on.
I think that's possible. I also think it's possible that perhaps she was a bit of a zealot and maybe she didn't have anybody else who thought like her that she was hanging out with.
Oh, that's also a good point.
So she may have isolated herself.
And one sort of final thing here is, you know, they're really skirting kind of a deep issue here, which is very, you know, has been very much an issue in actual our time, which is what happens to the people who are left behind, who the locals, as it were, who were left behind in the Bajorans, where he said they also have to evacuate the Bajorans who are working with them.
And we don't really deal with it at all.
Yeah.
In this episode. This is really about the only time it gets mentioned. We don't really know what happened. In fact, I think I have in my notes a few times where I ask, what about the Bajorans? What happened to all of them?
Yeah.
Everyone is bustling around trying to evacuate. Quark and Rom are watching as people rush by. Quark says, with hundreds of people trying to evacuate, but only 3 tiny runabouts available, this is an opportunity for profit. People will pay anything for a seat on those ships. Rom panics that his brother's going to leave him there, and Quark asks, do you actually believe I would sacrifice my own brother's life for personal profit? Rom nods, yes.
Oh, we've already seen this. Rom knows where Quark stands on this.
Quark says, we're both going to escape, but our bags will be filled with all the gold-pressed latinum we can carry. These two.
Yeah. But Rom in this scene, though, was the one who seemed to actually have some sympathy towards the people who were having to evacuate.
Yes.
He wasn't just purely looking at it from an opportunity to make profit.
Yeah. Well, Rom is nicer, generally.
Yeah. Did you notice the woman in the very purple outfit at 6:25 getting into the shuttle?
I did.
Also in the background, Morn, of course, again, at the bar, having a drink. We're evacuating the station. Where else is Morn going to be?
Morn goes where the people are.
Yeah. And I don't know if you noticed, because it wasn't terribly well in focus, but he appears to be in casual wear.
Morn?
Yes. He is not just wearing the silver puffy jacket that he's worn. He actually seems to have a little bit of color on it. I think he's in his evacuation clothes.
Yeah, but later when he evacuates, he's in his puffer jacket.
But it also has a little bit of color on the puffer jacket this time.
Ah. I did not. I'm going to have to go back and look.
I'm obsessed with watching the Barfly of the Prophets.
I understand. Jake and Nog find each other on the bustling promenade. Jake is wearing a very muted tan and brown outfit. He's really kind of gone down in his colors in season 2 compared to what he wore in season 1. Maybe now he's older. He likes muted colors.
Yeah.
But Nog has this strange purple sweater-like thing on. It's like half a sweater. It's very strange. They find that they are not on the same evacuation ships, but Nog says it'll be okay. He's very positive. He's sure this will be over in a few days and everything will be fine.
Nog is being so upbeat about this. It's touching that their friendship means so much.
Yeah. And poor Jake, he's so sad. And he says, just when I find a new home and a new friend, it always seems like I have to leave. It's like, aw.
Yes.
But Nog tries to make him feel better by asking if there has ever been one of your kind and one of my kind who were better friends. Never, Jake says. And if our fathers couldn't break us up, no stupid coup d'etat, Jake says, coup d'etat. It's French. Nog says, no stupid French thing can either.
That was nice.
I love that line.
Yeah.
He says, we'll see each other again soon. That's a promise. Then Odo comes by telling them to stop fooling about and get themselves to wherever they're supposed to be. He's always the disciplinarian.
O'Downer breaks up the touching scene.
I know. They hug and they smile and they go their separate ways. I mean, that scene was adorable.
Yes. And it reinforced the fact that they are such close friends.
I really loved what Nog was saying about nothing can stop us from being friends. He was just so positive. I was really impressed because he's not always that way.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of a role reversal. I mean, Jake seems to usually be the one who's very positive.
But it would make sense in this scenario that Jake would be struggling because he's going to leave by himself.
Yeah.
And he's bummed out that he was finally sort of happy in this place. And now he feels like something bad from his past is repeating itself. So it would make sense that he would be feeling a little bit bad.
That's
and
a really good take
on it. And
his
friend then would try to buck him up.
That's a good take on it. Yeah.
Now we go down to Miles' quarters, and Keiko is very upset that Miles is staying behind. He says he doesn't have any choice because Sisko needs him. She kind of snaps at him. I mean, she's just worried and doesn't like him choosing duty over family, but really, that's who Miles is.
Yeah.
And it's also kind of a bit of a trope in fiction, I suppose, that this person has got to stay behind, has got to defend the base.
Well, this is the downside of marrying a hero.
Miles says they can't let the Cardies have the wormhole. A bit of a low-level name-calling going on there, which is very on-brand for Miles.
Yeah.
And they head off to the evac ship, Miles carrying Molly.
Well, we've also touched that Miles' background is kind of a soldier. So that would make sense that he's going into this combat sort of mode.
Right. And in order to do something dangerous, you have to really feel a connection to the thing that you're protecting or the thing that you're fighting against. And he feels really strongly about fighting against Cardassians.
Oh, clearly, yeah.
Yeah. Now we go to ops. Dax has scanned all frequencies to Bajor and everything is jammed. The only way they're going to get through to the Chamber of Ministers is to physically take that UPS pad that Odo swiped from the Kursari vessel right to them.
Yep.
Getting there will be a challenge as Jaro will be watching for ships and they don't have a runabout available due to the evacuation. Lee Nalis then remembers hiding out some sub-impulse raiders underground at the Lunar 5 base, like 10 years ago, I think he says. Kira asks if one of the evac vessels could drop her off there. Sisko points out she'll be stranded there if she can't get the ship to fly. Then he asks Dax if any of her former hosts had experience with sub-impulse thruster configurations. Tobin Dax, she says, my second host. Barely a sex life and no imagination. This is a wildly inappropriate thing to say at this moment. Who would say that? But she says he knew phase coil inverters like no one else. They all ignore the sex life comment, because they should, and decide that that knowledge is going to come in handy today.
Finally, Dax's experience, all those lifetimes actually coming in useful.
Yeah. Then Odo drags Quark into ops, saying he's been selling seats on the evacuation vessels. Where did you get more seats? Sisko asks. Everyone always asks the broker, where did you get more seats? All I can say is it's my business to find preferred seating for a select list of clients. Then Sisko grabs him by the throat and says, I have more than 200 people who want to get off this station. I like how during this whole thing, Lee Nalis has zero reaction. He's like in the background just looking at him like, yeah, strangle him. Who cares? This is not important.
Now, strangling Quark, that doesn't seem very Federation.
I think we've seen pretty consistently with Sisko that he steps outside of what we think of as the Federation model from Picard.
Yeah.
And does something emotional. I think we've seen that a few times, including when he punched Q.
I also think maybe he's using a Ferengi cultural technique here, that he's adapting to the environment that he's in. He's doing that thing that Sisko can do. He changes mode to work for the moment he's in or the environment he's in. And I think that's typical of Ferengis, of they don't seem that bothered about threatening each other or being threatened.
But we also saw in Season 1, Episode 2, past prologue, where he did that sort of physically dominant thing to Kira. And I was a little upset by that because we really didn't see it again for a very long time.
Yeah.
And it made it look like that was just a thing he did with people who, I mean, I don't want to just say females, but, you know, with people that he was much bigger than and that he could show dominance to easily.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's similar with Quark, but not really. It actually kind of makes me happy that he's just sort of a hothead in these situations and it wasn't just specific to females.
Oh, interesting. Well, I still look at the Kira thing of that was an environmental thing, knowing the background that Kira came from.
And my comment on that is still, it's easy to say when you're the male.
I'll still go with, he's using an appropriate Ferengi cultural technique there in negotiating with Quark.
Okay. Quark finally says he made a few trades, a person here or there who decided not to leave. Then Bashir calls saying there's a panic happening at the airlock because far more passengers have shown up than they can handle, of course. And Quark says, I might have overbooked. Sisko lets him go, but is very frustrated. At this point, I'm like, why let him go? Keep strangling him, put him in a cell, do something. I mean, they let him get away with everything. There are never any consequences for Quark.
Well, I think there's a bigger issue going on here.
Yeah, obviously there is. Sisko and Nalis head off to the airlock. Quark calls after them that it's an accepted Ferengi transit practice. I feel perfectly justified. Then he turns to Odo and says, he has complete faith in Commander Sisko's ability to straighten this out. I'll pass that on, Odo says. He'll be so pleased to know he has your confidence.
Of course it's an accepted Ferengi practice. I mean, that,
of course,
you just know that's typical of the Ferengi. I mean, honestly,
absolutely,
it makes me wonder how their society functions at all.
Sure, and even from like the episode The Negus, where they talked about how they can't do business anywhere in the Alpha Quadrant anymore because everybody knows about all of their dealings.
Fake
that
news.
That also makes me wonder about it. It's like every now and then you have to do a legitimate deal or nobody would ever, ever, ever do any business with you. Then Quark heads out to join his brother on the evacuation ship. Down in the airlock, there's an unruly crowd of Bajorans trying to rush the runabout. Sisko pushes through them, saying, we have to get our families and children and non-Bajorans on board. But the shouting continues. Finally, Lee Nalis shouts, where are you running to? This is Bajor, and we're Bajorans. We fought a war to regain our homeland. How can you now abandon it like frightened Cardassian Vol? These ships are for our guests, who must leave because it is no longer safe for them here. However, we're Bajorans. I say we stay and solve our own problems together.
This actor really manages to deliver this well. The way he seems so sincere, he does seem like the inspiring leader. How can you not like this guy?
I mean, and finally, he does something useful. He hasn't been terribly useful so far, but he's also been really uncomfortable in his role and unsure of it. But here, yeah, he comes through.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure he's suffering from imposter syndrome.
Yes, absolutely.
When he really is a very genuine guy, and this little speech to the small crowd really puts that home. Plus, as a Bajoran, can you imagine a hero of your people telling you, you know, what are you doing? Why are you behaving like this? It would be very impactful.
Yeah, it would make you feel a little bit less about yourself. But sometimes you get caught up in the crowd, too.
Right.
You just go, oh, they're all getting on. I'm going to get on.
Yeah. Well, there's a crowd, so of course Morn's there.
Of course Morn is there. Morn is always where the crowd is.
He does enjoy a good mob, too.
He has. Since the very beginning, he's enjoyed an angry mob. There's murmurs of agreement from the crowd as the Bajorans disperse. And then Morn, Kira, and Dax all get on the ship as everybody else around leaves. Then Jake comes in with his suitcase and Sisko asks him if he's ready to go. Jake is like, maybe I should stay. I don't want anything to happen to you. Sisko says, that makes two of us. These two just break your heart with how sweet they are.
Yep.
Sisko gives Jake a little memory stick and says it's a letter he wrote to him, which is sweet and dark at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think he had time to write a letter, or is that just something he always has in his pocket?
I assume it's something he's always had.
Yeah.
Sisko has been in a lot of dangerous situations, so I'm sure it's something he has prepared for Jake in the event of something bad happening, which seems to be quite often.
All the time.
Yeah.
Jake says he'll read it as soon as he gets on the ship. Wait a while, Sisko says, and he takes his sweet little face in his hands. He hugs him and says, I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Miles comes off the runabout and says everyone is on. On the comm, Kira says they're proceeding with launch and wishes him luck. The doors all close, just as Quark comes in dragging his big heavy suitcase that's clunking with bars of gold-pressed latinum. Bashir says, Quark's name was not on the manifest, but Rom did get on board with a Dabo girl. What?
Good for Rom. He's learned a trick or two from his brother.
Well, Sisko smiles, looks like he sold your seat. They leave him there and head off.
Karma just caught up with Quark.
And then we go into the ad break.
Did you notice that just for a moment after Sisko lets Jake get onto the shuttle, the look on Sisko's face, it looks like he was about to cry.
Aw.
I mean, he has this really sort of upset look on his face. And then Miles walks out and then he just pulls it back together and is like straight back into the mode. I thought it was a nice touch, and it was, you know, another great insight, I thought, into the character of how he can put his emotion aside and just, you know, carry on with the job that needs to be done.
Yeah, you would have to be able to.
Oh, God, yeah.
I guess a little time has passed because the runabouts are gone and we see the assault vessels have docked at the station.
I love the space effect.
Then we see some armed Bajoran dudes in lavender uniforms come in through the airlock doors. And I hate to say this, but those lavender unis are not very threatening. They have very serious looks on their faces as they spread out. But those uniforms, they're just too cute. They don't look menacing.
Well, you know what's funny about that, though, is can you imagine things like that in this very wide world with different cultures and races and so on?
Yeah.
Different colors and things like that might mean very different things. They might be saying, well, we're wearing purple because like the most deadly snake or the most vicious animal on Bajor is purple colored. So, you know, we're wearing this color. So it'll frighten our enemies. Whereas, you know, people on Earth would go, oh, what a beautiful lilac bush.
Yes, it looks like a flower. So pretty. Steven Weber from Wings fame at the time of this show jumps through the airlock and shouts, clear, saying no resistance at all to General Krim as he walks through the door. Well, the Wings guy says, Jaro was correct. The Federation has tucked its tail between its legs. Then we see them coming into the promenade, and Krim wonders where the Bajoran officers who were working with Starfleet have gone. The place is deserted. Where's Lee Nollis? He wonders out loud. These are great questions, Mr. General. The Wings dude says, perhaps they knew this old station would never withstand a siege and they abandoned it with Starfleet. General Krim says, the most strategic position in the entire sector at the mouth of the wormhole. Had I been a Federation commander, I would not have abandoned it so easily.
Yeah, he doesn't seem convinced.
Now we get a close-up view of Steven Weber and his slicked back hair. He looks ridiculous. He's not threatening. He looks like he just stepped off the wing set and slicked back his hair. Maybe this is just me, but he looks silly.
Maybe he was just available and walked across the lot.
Maybe.
I did notice the Bajoran military doesn't seem to have any qualms about using women in combat.
True.
Also, you actually got to see different Bajoran races.
Yes. We go up into the vents, and we see Sisko, Miles, and Lee Nollis looking down on the invaders quietly hiding in the shielded conduits. Then we go to Dax and Kira, and they're on the abandoned lunar base and are entering a cave that is filled with giant spider webs. Kira says, "Can you believe a year ago I was living in a camp like this?" Dax is not loving the spider webs, and she says, "Trills are very allergic to insect bites. The biochemical connection between host and symbionts can't tolerate it." Then she shouts, pointing at something, "Is that a spider or a dog?" And it's a gigantic spider that's skittering away. And Kira says, "It's a palaku. The Bajoran moons are full of them." Dax is like, "I suppose you kept them as pets." Kira laughs. "No, we ate them." Dax is not thrilled with this whole thing. Kira is wearing her uniform here, but Dax is not. Did you notice that?
Yes.
It seems like all of the Starfleet folks changed out of their uniforms when they decided not to evacuate.
Yeah, they're all wearing civilian uniforms. So, in theory, does that make them terrorists?
I don't know. Then they find a rusty little vessel in the cave, and Dax wonders if it will fly. "I've seen worse," Kira says as she knocks the spider webs off of it and opens it up. I love how skittish Dax is about all the spider webs. I would be the same way, because that stuff is gross. It sticks to you, you can't get it off.
Well, it's very good motivation to get the ship working.
That's true, and get out of there. As Kira ducks and climbs in, Dax says, "The Bajoran resistance must have had a lot of short pilots." "No," Kira says, "short engineers." She says, "They were always building these things without thinking." "Oh, that's encouraging," Dax says. "Just bend your knees, you'll fit." They squeeze in, Kira in the front and Dax in the back. Kira has to pull the lever a few times to get the door closed. She fires it up, saying, "The real trick will be to fire up these thrusters. It was hard enough to get them going when they were being used every day." Dax opens up the back panel, saying she'll get them fired up because she has no intention of getting stuck on this moon eating palakus.
Those giant spiders are things of nightmares.
Yeah, and that was a really big spider. I love that she asked if it was a spider or a dog. That was hilarious. Back on the station, the Lavender Bajorans are coming up the elevator into the empty ops.
Squad Lavender.
This obviously terrible person Steven Weber is playing says, "We should inform Minister Jaro of our success immediately." He's chewing the scenery a little bit.
Yeah.
It's like his script says, "You are a bad guy." General Krim says, "You're too eager to receive his plaudits, Colonel." Yes, he has that not-so-subtle suck-up quality. I'm going to call him Colonel Wings from now on because we don't know his name, but we know he's a colonel.
That's a good name, Colonel Wings.
Colonel Wings looks like his ego was bruised, so he immediately calls his dad, Jaro. This guy does not understand the chain of command. The general just told him not to do it, and he did it anyway. How did he get promoted to colonel? So that's why I thought maybe Jaro was his dad. One of the NPCs informs Krim that the security net is completely disabled. So Krim says to scan the operations center for organic material because the security chief is apparently missing. Aren't they all technically missing? He says it's possible the shapeshifter left with the evacuation ships, or perhaps there's something more here than meets the eye. He says to scan 6 times an hour at random intervals. Then Jaro appears on subspace. Colonel Wing says, "Minister, I'm pleased to inform you that we've encountered no resistance so far. Worst soldier ever." Now, can't follow the rules within 2 seconds.
He's a little overconfident, I think.
Krim is annoyed that he made this call prematurely. Jaro is happy the Federation has withdrawn, and he wants to announce that we've secured the station. But General Krim urges caution. He's not convinced that Starfleet really left, because there's no way to track anyone on board with the security net down. Jaro says Lee Nalis wouldn't abandon Bajor. He must still be there. "Take every necessary step to keep Lee Nalis alive," Jaro says. "Dead, he's a martyr. Alive, he seals our victory." And he hangs up. Then the camera pulls back in Jaro's room, and Vedic Wen is in the background. She says, "Once you have him, Lee will see the wisdom of giving you his support. I'll offer him anything he wants to make sure he does," Jaro says. "You have a unique ability to build a consensus, Essa." She grabs his shoulder. "Bajor has been waiting for a leader like you." Yeah, let's see. Kidnaps people. He beats them up. Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, these two really are the axis of evil.
Oh, man. He puts his hands then on her shoulders and says into her ear, "26 hours after I'm sworn into office, I'll direct the Vedic Assembly to elect you Kai, and together we will rebuild Bajor."
Do you think they'll make Bajor great again?
Oh my gosh. And they're doing that weird kind of soap opera thing where they're having a conversation, but they're both facing the camera, not the way that people speak to each other in the real world. But it adds to the melodrama.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I like this little touch as well. I mean, clearly he needs the Kai to get a religious justification for what he's doing. And Vedic Wynn needs him to basically become the Kai. So it's a very mutually beneficial arrangement.
Exactly. Neither one of them are going to succeed independently.
Yeah. I mean, they're also showing how they're just both ruthless people.
It's actually good leadership. Not that you're leading to something noble, but it's a good way to get people to do what you want.
Yes.
Let's put it that way. It's a good show of manipulation.
Yes. It's good sociopathic leadership.
There you go. Back on Lunar 5, Dax and Kira get the little ship fired up. The inside of the ship is starting to smoke, and Dax is coughing. "Don't turn the engines off," she says. "We'll never get them started again." Then she hits her head on the low ceiling, and Kira tells her to bend her knees again, which is less than helpful since she's already sitting down.
Doesn't help that Jadzia is so tall.
Kira is having a nostalgic moment from the engine noise, and Dax can't believe they won a war in these things. Kira says, "We were the insects, and the Cardassians were just as allergic as Trills." We love a good analogy on this show. She asks if the proximity system is working, and Dax smacks something with her fist and says, "I think so." Kira says, "Okay, let's see if we can get out of here without bouncing off any walls." General Krim is at Sisko's desk where the baseball still sits. This seems like a sign they never left, that baseball was there. Colonel Wings wants to take action, and he doesn't understand why, if Krim knows they're still on board, he's just sitting there waiting to be attacked. But Krim says he understands military tactics, and he knows they aren't interested in attacking because they're so outnumbered. But then, guess what happens? Before he can finish the sentence, the lights go out. But honestly, that could mean anything at this station. The lights go out every other episode.
Yeah, Miles wasn't there to keep on hitting the generator every 20 minutes and making it work. I mean, that's just normal operations on there.
Totally. One of the Lavender NPCs comes in and says the primary sensor array was sabotaged. "Let your engineers play with the machines," Colonel Wing says. "I'm sending out search parties." Krim is not in charge of this dude at all.
Yeah. This makes me wonder, what is the actual command structure here? This guy seems to have basically the same authority as the general. So I was wondering if he's actually a political officer. So he's nominally a colonel, but has the same command authority as the general.
I wonder if the military for Bajor is still a little bit immature.
Oh.
And they're all still used to just being, you know, sort of a ragtag bunch of people.
Yeah.
And they haven't had that organized structure very long. And so it's not quite as militaristic as it should be.
Right. Who made you general? I didn't vote for you.
Either that or Colonel Wing's dad is Jaro.
It could be.
Up in the conduits, Miles is handing out military rations, saying, "Eat hearty. The replicators crash in 16 minutes. Sisko wonders why he didn't replicate something more palatable, but Miles loves them. They're a miracle of science. Sisko was hoping for a French onion soup, which is not exactly a portable food that you would eat in a conduit, so that just seemed like a weird reference.
Yeah, MREs would make a lot more sense.
As Miles is going on and on about how great the rations are, Lee Nalis makes a very sour face as he eats his.
And this is a guy who's been living in a Cardassian labor camp.
Good point. Bashir and another group are in a different conduit with Quark. He makes an ug-like face when he sniffs his energy bar-like food, whatever that black thing is.
Yeah.
They discuss the bad food over comms a bit when Odo calls, saying, "A patrol is approaching. I'll get back to you in a minute," and everyone goes quiet. And below in the dark, we see Lavender soldiers on the hunt. Why wouldn't you assume that they were in the conduits? I just think that's so strange they didn't even think of it.
I know, right? That would be like the first place I'd look.
Right.
Maybe they don't have good schematics of the station. Perhaps they, you know, it was a rush for them to get there and they actually didn't go well prepared.
Which again would be a clue about the military being a little bit immature. Odo then oozes out of a wall partway and he lets the team know that a 5-man unit is about to begin a search of the cargo deck. Bashir says that puts them closest to me. Bashir at this point has what looks like a water bottle in his hand, like something he picked up off of the food services table and wasn't supposed to be in the shot. Miles then wonders if they should send someone who can help Bashir, like Lee. Sisko says, "No, I need him here with us." And he calls Bashir back and says, "You know what to do. Use deadly force only if necessary."
Okay, this explains something I was thinking. Why didn't they let the Bajoran forces get on board and then just vent the place?
I see, because Sisko says only use deadly force if necessary. Because, yeah, they could have gassed him. They could have done all kinds of things.
Yeah, I'm guessing he just doesn't want unnecessary casualties. Sisko is too nice a guy.
Well, but if you look at the situation, I mean, they figured out that the weapons are coming from the Cardassians, but nobody knows that. So I think he's not seeing really that there's a bad guy. But at the same time, Jaro, no matter where his weapons are coming from, is trying to overthrow the provisional government, regardless of who's supplying the weapons. He's still doing that.
I guess Sisko doesn't want to cause any Bajoran casualties because then it will be like, oh, you're just like the Cardassians. You don't hesitate to kill Bajorans if they get in your way.
Well, there's that, but there's also the fact that right now he does not have Starfleet on his side. Starfleet told him to get out.
Yeah.
So he's acting independently. So then it would make even more sense that he doesn't want to kill anyone.
Agreed.
In the cargo bay, the Lavender soldiers are poking around. When Julian shouts, "Don't get too close to that, it's thorium isotope," and then he kicks out a ceiling panel, and somehow nobody fires, which I thought was strange, and people pop out of the containers and they capture all of the Lavender soldiers on this patrol awfully easily.
I think because they were totally surprised, and as the soldiers reacted, they had guns right in their faces.
But they shouldn't be surprised because they're looking for people hiding out.
They sent the B team to the station.
Or the C team with Commander Wings. Colonel Wings.
Yeah.
He calls Sisko and says, "Mission accomplished. We have our first 5 prisoners of war." This is that Wild West stuff that Bashir was looking forward to in the first episode.
I think so.
Right? Sisko looks happy and he winks at Miles, who is surprised Julian didn't honk it all up. I kind of like that part where Miles just assumed that Bashir was going to mess it up because he does not like him or respect him. But Sisko showed faith in him and he came through. I thought that little scene was cool.
Yeah, it was. I did like the way Sisko winked. I mean, also, there was some big hair in this scene as well.
That's the one who was engaged to the Bajoran?
I think so.
Yeah, her hair was pretty big. The hair is pretty funny on this show sometimes. Yeah.
It's a big hair episode.
So Dax and Kira have their little ship flying.
It's a really cool little ship.
Kira says she's preparing to establish a high-altitude orbit over Bajor. The panel in front of Dax looks like someone spilled coffee down the front of it. Did you see that? It was like stained brown.
I didn't.
Oh, gosh.
I did like that this was a contrast between Starfleet technology of the whole thing looked pretty lived in.
Yes. Star Warsy.
Yes.
Dax says navigational sensors aren't functioning. I'm guessing because somebody spilled coffee on the controls.
I'll do it.
No problem, Kira says. Dax says, big problem. Then Kira is like, we'll have to fly by the seat of our pants. Great, seat of the pants technology, Dax says sarcastically. I liked all of the interactions with these two. They make a good team because of how different they are.
Oh, yeah.
Though Dax is usually a little more calm and cool and collected, but she was outside of her comfort zone here, and Kira was right in the middle of her comfort zone.
Oh, precisely. I mean, this is massively outside of the Federation kind of thinking and behavior. I mean, I liked how Kira was sort of poking fun at Dax, her reliance on technology and gizmos, as Kira put it.
She says, you Starfleet types are too dependent on gadgets and gizmos.
Yeah.
Which is like what software engineers say about other software engineers who only know how to use tools and not use the command line.
Right.
Yes.
Which is also very true.
Kira is really enjoying herself. She says, you lose your natural instincts of survival when you depend on technology. Dax says her natural instincts said not to climb on board this ship. And then, of course, somebody starts shooting at them. Dax doesn't know what's happening because none of the sensors are working. Kira tries evasive maneuvers. Dax uses her tricorder to detect impulse engines. Kira flips the ship around dramatically and sees a couple of Bajoran ships firing at them. They can't outrun them, so Kira says we have to level the playing field by going into the Bajoran atmosphere because they can't use their impulse engines there. Dax looks very worried, like, why did I go on this stupid mission? This is a terrible idea.
So that's a pretty long-range tricorder that Dax has there. Thought tricorders were short-range.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting that she used her tricorder. I don't know, maybe something like an impulse engine gives off whatever an impulse engine gives off.
Oh.
Big enough signal.
Yeah, something that would be pretty easy to detect. Okay.
Yeah.
Or she just bought the pro model.
She got the upgrade.
Yeah.
Then we go back to the station, and Lee and Miles are crawling around somewhere in the dark. I think it's in Odo's office, but it's hard to tell because it's dark.
Yeah.
Miles is pulling something out of a panel when they are fired upon. They have to duck down under the desk for safety, and they call Sisko for help. This plan seems very suspicious, like many plans that we make. But everybody is such a bad shot, nobody hits anything.
They are all terrible shots. Couldn't they, like, put a sight on the phases?
Yeah.
I assume the Federation side are deliberately shooting to miss.
Maybe.
But the Bajoran side, I mean, wow.
I didn't think about that, yeah. Sisko and some of his Starfleet helpers sneak in from a different side and start shooting at the Lavender soldiers. One of the Starfleet NPCs with no lines presses some buttons on a little ball and rolls it towards the entrance of the room that Miles and Lee are in, which I think is Odo's office. Sisko shoots to distract the Lavender soldiers as smoke starts coming out of the ball.
It's good to see that smoke is still an effective battlefield weapon in the future.
Right? I thought that was cute.
Yeah.
In the smoke, Lee and Miles escape while Sisko covers them with phaser fire.
Team Lavender lose again.
Odo appears and then quickly turns himself into a tripwire, tripping the Lavender soldiers as they're trying to chase after them. And Sisko and his team gets away. I like that effect. That was cool.
Yes. Odo proves to be very useful.
Especially as he's sneaking around and nobody even knows he's there.
That makes me wonder, could you detect him with a tricorder? If they had a tricorder, couldn't they just scan around looking for him?
Because he's organic material.
Yeah. Or is it too difficult?
Well, but he can make himself so small and he can move around so quickly. I don't know if you had to be... I don't know, though. We just established in the previous scene that a tricorder could detect impulse engines quite a ways away. So you'd think you could use a tricorder on the whole station. Yeah. It's a little foggy there.
Certainly on a large enough section.
That's a little hand wavy, I'll grant you. Down in the atmosphere, Dax and Kira are still getting shot at. She says the problem is the guys flying those other ships used to fly these little ships, so they know a lot about them.
Excellent. She is pointing out exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. They have phasers, but no way to aim. No problem, Kira says. Oh, with the seat of your pants, Dax asks. Not with your pants, with your eyes, Lieutenant. Just point and fire. This was adorable. I love that. You fly, I'll shoot, Dax says. Hang on, Kira shouts as she flies straight up, and Dax looks like she might vomit. Then Dax fires a few times until she hits one of the ships. One ship down, but the other fires on them, hitting a plasma conduit and impacting their thrusters. And Kira says they need to land, and there's no time to find a safe spot. Kira just puts her head in her hands in a crash pose, and Dax does the same, and down they go. That was a short-lived battle.
There's been a lot of crashing on this show.
There has been.
Yeah.
Back on the station, another Lavender patrol with Colonel Wings is looking around in Quark's. They find one of the holosuites is in use, and they all head in like morons. Nope, they don't even leave anybody on the outside. They all go in. Is this like the oldest trick in the book? Cisco Miles and Lee Nalis are in there, but when they go for their weapons, the door shuts behind them and the holographic images all disappear. And Cisco comes on the intercom and says, please listen very carefully. The Bajoran idiots all point their phasers at the ceiling, like he's talking to them through the ceiling. They are not very smart.
Shoot the speaker.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so we've proved it's the F squad.
Totally. I think it's because they're being commanded by Colonel Wings.
Oh.
He clearly thinks he's way smarter than he is. Cisco says the Cardassians are supplying the weapons for the coup. Ridiculous, Colonel Wing shouts. No Bajoran would ever accept help from them. Jaro doesn't know, Cisco says. The Cardassians are using the Kursari to deliver the weapons to the Circle. That's a Federation lie, Colonel Wing says. But Cisco says the proof is on the way to Bajor. Once this evidence is presented, the coup will end. We don't want to fight you or hurt anyone. Your officers will be our guests for a while. Then they beam Colonel Wings back to Ops. I imagine for him to deliver this message to Krim. Although if they're able to communicate into the holosuite, why can't they communicate into Ops?
I assume that was just they hacked into the holosuite locally.
Okay. When Colonel Wings appears in Ops, Krim says, Day, what the hell is going on? I think that's the first time they said his name, but Colonel Wings is his name from now on.
Yeah, agreed.
He says he was taken prisoner, and the Federation is behind all of this. Krim wonders why Cisco let him go, and Colonel Wings just makes up a story that he promised them amnesty, a promise he had no intention of keeping.
Oh, so he's lying.
He just made that up.
Do you think that he just doesn't believe Cisco, that it's fake news?
Yeah, he thinks it's all lies. I think he said... that Cisco said nothing of consequence, and I believe he meant that.
Oh, okay.
Then the security net comes back online, and Krim says, scan for their communication devices. Not picking anything up, the NPC says, and Krim realizes they must be in a shielded location. Colonel Wing says the conduits are shielded by duranium composite, which is a useful fact you could have brought up earlier.
Or the fact there was conduits on the station.
Oh my god. Then that's where they are, Krim says. I mean, duh. God, these guys are dumb. Then we go back down to the planet in what appears to be a bit of a jungle, and Dax is crawling around. Kira is badly injured and not moving.
She gets hurt in every crash landing.
Dax is like, we can't stay here. They're looking for us. Kira says to just leave her and get the evidence to the provisional government. Drink. Dax thinks the message would be a lot more convincing coming from her, but Kira says the evidence speaks for itself. You have to leave me. She gives Dax the UPS pad, and she says, that's an order, Lieutenant, and Dax is having none of it. She's like, the Federation officially left Bajor yesterday, so you're no longer my commanding officer. She tells Kira to get up, even though Kira says she can't walk. This is a bit of a reversal from Move Along Home, where Dax was the injured one and told Cisco and Kira to leave her, remember that?
Yep, and Kira pointed out that she wasn't a Federation officer, so she can't be court-martialed.
Oh, that's right. Then we hear somebody shouting, over there, and they duck down as we see legs walking by. Kira then just passes out from pain or a head injury or something.
Yeah, I have to agree with Dax here. It really does need to come from Kira. If it did come from Dax, I bet there'd be a portion of the ministers saying, oh, it's lies, it's made up by the Federation.
Whereas
coming from somebody like Kira, who is recognized as a war hero and a veteran, they're more likely to believe her that this is real.
And also, I would say, as a friend and someone who is invested in Kira, and as a team member, you would want Kira to be the one who delivers that, because that is important for her growth and for her future.
Oh, yeah, very true.
There's the leadership portion of the podcast.
Just one of the leadership portions.
Just one. We're doing this thing that we always do when we get towards the climax of one of the Deep Space Nine stories, and we're flashing back really quickly between all the different things going on. Back on the station, Lee and Miles are crawling out of a conduit. Odo calls, saying he hopes they aren't on level 5 because they are about to gas the conduits on that level. Sisko says they're on level 3, and he looks at Miles, and Miles says, "Oh, well, that's a good idea. It's the kind of thing I would have done." We have to get out of here soon. Sisko is worried that they haven't heard anything from Kira or Dax yet, but I'm not sure exactly how they would hear from them because the comms were jammed. But we called Jaro earlier, so maybe the comms aren't jammed anymore?
I would assume if Kira got through and convinced them that the Cardassians were supplying weapons, they would have unblocked the comms and Sisko would have been able to hear through the normal channels.
I see. If those two don't succeed on their mission, Sisko says, we still have an ace in the hole, and he looks at Lee Nalis. He tells Miles to get the units ready to move out. Then he tells Lee that Jaro's plan depends on the military's support. Without it, the coup fails. And you think I can sway the generals? Lee asks. But Sisko is only concerned with one general right now, and that's Krim. He picked the wrong side, and we need to convince him of that. Would you rather follow a politician or Bajor's greatest war hero? Lee has never liked being labeled a hero, and he says, I've done everything I can. I would die for my people. Sisko says, sure you would. Dying gets you off the hook. The question is, are you willing to live for your people? Live the role they want you to play. That's what they need from you right now.
Oh, another great speech from Sisko.
Yeah.
I mean, Sisko really gets to the point here. Lee Nalis is such a reluctant hero and really doesn't want to use that role of being a hero of the people and being this icon. And I think it speaks so much to the character of the guy, of his integrity, that he doesn't feel justified in even using that.
There's also the imposter syndrome thing, where he doesn't believe that he's a hero, so he doesn't believe that he could move the generals or a single general.
Yeah.
So he needs Sisko to help convince him. This is also a good leadership moment, I suppose. But also, just in general, there's a long Star Trek history of speeches by captains that change the course of everything.
Right.
Kira gasps, waking up suddenly. Vedic Barile is in the room, and he tells her she's safe, and that the entire city saw her ship go down. Someone from his order found them. She asks about Dax, and Barile says she's fine, she's changing clothes. We've got to get to the Chamber of Ministers. She climbs out of bed and then kind of falls, grabbing onto him. Careful, he smiles. You just had a broken hip mended, which is probably why she passed out.
Ow. That's my only comment on that one.
She asks how long she's been there, and he says 6 hours. We have to get out of here, she says, and she starts limping towards the exit, very determined.
Oh, yeah. She is not going down without a fight.
I love it. And the whole left side of her uniform is like burned up and there's a big hole in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then Dax comes in, dressed all in Vedic robes like Vedic Wynn. She's like, oh, you're up. Put this on, and starts putting a similar outfit on to Kira. Barile says only members of the religious orders can travel safely through the streets. He says that he'll escort them. This is when I realized that was the outfit that Dax had on in Kira's migraine vision.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So we're on to something.
Yep.
Then they argue about whether or not Barile should go along, but he's going. And then Dax asks Kira what she thinks of her disguise, because she's got a crinkled Bajoran nose.
Yep.
Oh, Kira says, it's flattering. And Dax says, I'm thinking of keeping it. Dax is so quirky. She is the weirdest character sometimes.
Yep.
She just says these weird things in these, you know, really intense situations. She's very entertaining.
I think they're starting to build the character that she has these sort of goofy side, that she's is very smart. She has all this experience and ability, but also has this sort of funny, goofy aspect to her.
Yeah, I would have to say this is my favorite version of Dax so far.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're 22 episodes in.
Well, they really struggled with that character early on, of just badly written what to do with her.
Well, they've struggled with a lot of characters.
Yeah.
And I think Bashir shows his best, you know, up till this point. I think Miles shows his best up till this point. Dax shows her best. Yeah, we're getting somewhere.
Yeah, agreed.
Now Bashir is yelling at Quark, who is slow to get out of the conduit because of his heavy suitcase. He tries to claim it's his personal mementos, but Bashir is like, yeah, right, it's gold-pressed latinum. And Quark says, who told you? And Bashir says, your mother did, the day you were born. And then Quark gets all mad and like crawls up to him and says, never make fun of a Ferengi's mother. Rule of acquisition number 31. But the full rule also includes insult something he cares about instead. But Quark doesn't give the full line.
They might not have written the full line yet.
Oh, maybe. Then Sisko calls saying they're in position. He tells Bashir to make as much noise as you can before you surrender. Bashir says, we'll make them think there are 200 of us instead of 20. Quark finally starts to leave his suitcase behind, but then he ends up going back for it. He just can't give it up. In Ops, they're about to move on to flooding level 3 when the NPC says the enemy has attacked their position in airlock 14. Colonel Wing sends all security units to airlock 14, thinking they flushed them out. Krim wants a visual, but of course the surveillance cameras have been sabotaged.
Both of the cameras? We keep on complaining about how they don't have any.
Yeah, right. Then they get a call that the enemy forces at airlock 14 have surrendered. Bring the leaders to me, Krim says. He looks confused before he heads back up into Sisko's office. Once he's in the office, Sisko, Miles, Odo, and Lee Nalis are there with phasers pointed at the general. And Lee introduces himself to the general. Like, maybe you've heard of me. I thought that was great.
That was a nice touch. I like the way the actor plays Lee as this very understated character.
Yeah, he's really good.
Very calm and just sort of pleasant is the only way I can describe it.
Yeah, he's really good. I like it. He's very down to earth.
Yeah.
Back down on Bajor, Kira, Dax, and Baryl enter the Chamber of Ministers, removing their robes. Well, not Baryl, but the other two. Jaro sends the guards to grab Kira as Vedic Wynn says, "What is this blasphemy? Her favorite word. How many times has she said blasphemy? She is awesome."
Yes.
Kira says, "I'm Major Kira Nerys, and I've come with proof that the Cardassians are behind Minister Jaro's attempt to take control of the government." Vedic Wynn looks suddenly concerned and also not thrilled, and she distances herself a little bit from Minister Jaro.
Oh, yeah. She appears to jump ship very quickly on this one. Do you think she knew the truth, or she suspected it, or do you think that she's just such an opportunist that when this came up and appears to be true, she's immediately onto, oh, he's a traitor?
That's a very interesting question. I don't think that she knew what was going on, but I think she's always prepared, A, to lie, and B, protect herself.
That's what I assumed. I assumed it literally was just a political move. As soon as she saw the winds changing direction, she is 100% right. in the other camp of, oh, I can't believe he did this.
Yes.
Very much a survivor.
For sure. Minister Jaro says, "Major Kira has long been an outspoken opponent of the provisional government, also of reason, of progress, and now, finally, of me. I'm honored to be included, Major, but I have no intention of letting you disrupt the orderly transition of power with these wild charges." Then Kira pulls out the UPS pad. This is a manifest pad from a Kursari vessel. It bears the thumb scan of a Cardassian gull who transferred weapons to that ship. Those weapons were taken by the Kursari to the Circle. The coup will deliver Bajor back into the hands of its greatest enemies. Are you willing to live under Cardassian rule again? Jaro is like, "There is nothing to these accusations." "Well," says Evil Wynn, "then you should have no objection to an inspection of the manifest." She takes the UPS pad from Kira. "No, of course not," Jaro says. "We'll adjourn for the time being. I completely support this investigation, and I fully intend to cooperate." Then all the ministers start clamoring around Kira, and they're all making a bunch of noise and sort of jabbering to each other, just like from her migraine vision.
Oh, yeah. Her vision appears to have come true.
Although she does continue to have her clothes on, unlike in the vision.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, is there going to be naked time with Baryl in the next scene?
Not in this episode. Back in Ops, General Krim is waiting as the elevator comes up with Colonel Wings, Bashir, and Quark. I'm not sure where everybody else is that they captured.
And I didn't think Quark was one of the leaders.
Oh, that's funny, actually. Krim is annoyed at Wings and says he deliberately withheld information regarding the Cardassians that was to be communicated to him. Colonel Wings is like, "It's all lies.
Fake news."
Krim says, "We've been told the Chamber of Ministers is in recess while evidence of Cardassian involvement is being examined. The circle is broken, Colonel," Sisko says. He's been waiting for 3 episodes to say that.
Oh, yeah.
Colonel Wings looks pissed. Krim is returning to the surface immediately to consult with the ministers, and he expects that he'll be asked to resign. Then he turns to Sisko and he says, "Commander, since the provisional government, has prevailed, I believe it's appropriate to return command of the station to Starfleet." Sisko nods. Krim turns to Lee Nalis and says, "Well fought, sir." But it's not over for Colonel Wings. As everyone starts to leave, he shouts, "No!" and goes for his phaser, pointing it at Sisko. Lee Nalis dives on him, taking the point-blank rage shot. Colonel Wings throws him off, but before he can get another shot off, Odo grabs him and his phaser. Sisko runs over to Lee, who's on the floor, smiling, and he says, "Off the hook, after all." Which was a very annoying cliche, to have the guy say something witty as he dies. That is just one of my least favorite tropes in all of fiction.
Yes, it is.
Sisko is bummed. He was just starting to really like that guy.
He dies a hero, though.
I wish we could have gotten a good look at Sisko's outfit in this episode. It looks really cool, but it's dark in every scene, and you can't really see it. Because he's got, like, a cool jacket, and he's got these cool boots, but we never really see it. Kira is back on the station. Her uniform is repaired, and she is sitting at Quark's bar. She is desperately sad. She says, "Somehow you figured now that he was here, things would be better. You know, he'd find a way to make things better because he was a man who could do that, a great man. I wish I knew where we could find others like him. Major, Sisko says, there are heroes all over Bajor. I'm sitting with one now. That's the truth. She risked her life multiple times.
Yeah.
And she's shown more intent than Lee Nalis in terms of what she was going to do or willing to do for Bajor.
Yep.
But at the same time, she took inspiration from the legend, which Sisko has pointed out all along. So
yeah, which is the arguably the more important thing. As Sisko points out to him, he's an icon for the people.
Right.
Sisko, again, does that sort of quiet voice speech to her and delivers it, you know, wonderfully, trying to help a friend as much as anything. All Kira's heroes get killed. Kaiopaka, now Lee Nalis.
Right.
The people who've been the icons of her life are falling in front of her.
It's true. She says, I'm sorry, I don't feel like celebrating tonight, and she excuses herself. Miles leans over to Sisko and says, listening to Kira talk about all he was, all he did, all he was going to do, she makes him sound like he was larger than life, like he was some kind of military genius. But the Lee Nalis I fought with, Sisko interrupts him. Chief, Lee Nalis was the hero of the Bajoran resistance. He performed extraordinary acts of courage for his people, and he died for their freedom. That's how the history books on Bajor will be written, and that's how I'll remember him when anybody asks. Yes, sir, Miles says. Then Dax calls saying the Ganges is docked, and they both head off to meet their respective families. Sisko grabs Jake when he sees him, both of them very happy. The end.
Oh, great ending. The war is over. The families are reunited.
Yep.
And Jake and Sisko seem very happy to see each other.
Oh, yes, nice they touch. Did seem very happy. Okay, well, let's talk over analysis. What have you got? There's a lot to analyze.
There's lots of things to over analyze in this one.
Yeah.
I assume the circle is completely discredited as well as broken because right. A member of the circle killed one of the great heroes of Bajor. How can you be a patriot and kill the hero of your people? I assume that's why it would lose any real support.
Yeah, I really worry too about the Bajoran military at this point because they had leaders.
Yeah.
And those leaders all made bad decisions to follow the circle, or at least some of them did.
Yeah.
And now you're going to end up promoting people who aren't ready into those higher positions. And I think they're going to be thinned out even more than they already were.
Oh, yeah, that is true.
But also, that's a lot of times when people really step up.
Yeah. I think the biggest question now is, how much did Jaro know? Did he know where the weapons were coming from? Did he not want to know?
Yeah, was he not asking enough questions? He was just getting his hands on the weapons.
I wonder, was he really a patriot? Or was he just a power-hungry despot in league with the Cardassians? We don't really get an answer to that. People say, oh, he hated the Cardassians, he fought against them. Do we really know that? I like that because it's something that's left open.
Yeah, we don't know that. And also we know that he did employ some Cardassian techniques when he was interrogating Kira.
Right.
Although he always kept his hands clean.
Right. I think it could go either way.
Yeah.
I lean towards him deliberately not knowing where this stuff was coming from. The plausible deniability kind of thing.
I think that when you put him together with Vedic Wynn, it's such an interesting partnership, those two.
Yeah.
They both seem to be about Bajor for Bajorans.
Yeah.
I don't think either one of them thinks that it's all about themselves and that they're trying to get themselves into power. I truly believe that the two of them think that they're doing the right thing for the people.
I think that's true of Wynn. I think she's massively ambitious, but at the same time, she is a zealot and she believes in a single view of the prophets. But I also think she's an abuser of power.
She's an abuser of her religion, for sure. Yeah. And I think we've seen that throughout history.
I think Jaro, I'm not sure. I really don't know. It could go either way.
Yeah. Well, one thing's for sure.
Yes.
Frank Langella was amazing.
Oh, he was outstanding.
I mean, he was. He was so outstanding.
Yeah, he really carried that role.
Totally agreed. He was just great. And so was Vedic Wynn.
Oh, yeah. Probably no spoilers here, but this actually is the last time we see Frank Langella on the show.
That is such a bummer. Okay, what else have you got for overanalysis?
Now, another point is, so we know that if the Federation left, the Cardassians would come back. Are the Circle completely blind to this? Are they so wrapped up in this Bajoran supremacist racial purity identity thing that they'll actually ignore the facts of the situation and have some bizarre view like, if the Federation leaves, there's no way the Cardassians would come back because we'd defeat them again, regardless of the reality of it.
I think that's part of why they were stockpiling all the weapons.
Yeah.
Because they thought that made them stronger, and now they had a united military, and they were going to have a tougher leader who was, you know, prepared for it. So yeah, I think they were kind of kidding themselves to some degree. I mean, a much smarter politician would be very focused on building an alliance with somebody strong like the Federation who would protect them.
Yeah.
But it's hard to know, I guess, how they got to the point. They have all these people now who are so concerned about being oppressed that they're not open to building alliances.
My take on it is that they were in denial using basically a Bajoran supremacist approach. If they believed that they were superior, or enough of them believed that they were the superior race, they could easily defeat the Cardassians, even though the Cardassians have a huge empire and resources to back it up.
History tells us how stupid and dangerous that is.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But Earth history.
Well, yeah, just Earth history. That's what I took from it. That's why they were thinking that way. Completely misguided. So next point. What's the betting that Guldakat was completely behind this?
Yeah, that seems legit. I mean, he was the one who came on and made that whole big thing about, oh, we had no idea we had this labor camp and that we were holding any prisoners. That was somebody else, and we've taken care of it. We're your friends now. So he was really doing a look over here, everything's okay.
Yeah, exactly. I made the assumption that the POW camp was being run under the radar, that the Cardassians weren't really that bothered about keeping the POWs, and it wasn't a big deal until they got caught. And then suddenly it was like, whoa, back off.
It seems silly that they had them. It was like a handful of people.
Yeah, but it was probably still cheap labor. And that's why I think it was something done, you know, under the radar. And then all of a sudden it became a huge problem for Gul Dukat because he had this other operation that was in progress.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Though I don't know why they needed anybody to be picking up those rocks.
They were very valuable rocks. And the other thing that I start thinking about is, I'm wondering how Dukat managed to get out of this being a failure. I'm picturing political maneuvering behind the scenes of how he avoids this being held over him at some point. Who is his fall guy?
Oh, I know who it is.
Who?
It's the guy whose thumbprint was on the UPS
pad. Oh, nice
one. That guy's out.
Oh.
He's going to totally be the fall guy.
Because I bet there's no paper trail leading to Dukat. I bet there's nothing with his signature on it or thumbprint or whatever. I can see him as being like a real paperwork operative. Amongst all his other nefarious talents, being able to blame other people is probably right up there.
Any other overanalysis?
No, I think that wraps it up.
Well, the three-parter was intense. Let's move on to women in the future.
Okay.
Kira and Dax on a mission by themselves to save the day. Good call. Really enjoyed that.
Yes, the interaction between the two of them was great.
Yes, I like their interactions. I like that they needed both of their strengths in order to survive, and that when Kira was injured, Dax wouldn't leave her behind. Those were all very Starfleet-y things, all very Star Trek-y things, so I appreciated that. And also, I appreciated that Kira's attitude, as always, is, I might not make it, but I'm going all in because this is a thing I need to do to save the day. Like when there's a chance that she might get stuck on that moon if she goes by herself. And Sisko's like, well, you might be waiting there a long time before anybody could rescue you. She's like, yeah, okay, sure.
Yeah.
She has no doubt of what it is that she wants to do. And she doesn't view it as being the hero. She just views it as, I need to do this thing for Bajor. She just has this never-ending desire to serve Bajor.
Well, she has this huge sense of duty.
Yes.
That comes out in any time she's carrying out a mission or has to do something important.
Yeah, and I appreciate that because quite often it's a male character that they give that to. And not very frequently is it a female character. So I like it when they do that. And then they don't kind of get mixed into like the sexual harassment stuff that we've seen on the show, the creeping that we've seen on the show. I mean, we didn't have that. Well, we didn't have very much of that sort of garbage in this 3-episode arc. And I really appreciated it. This is the best thing we've seen so far of Deep Space Nine. These 3 episodes, all 3 of them were great. And I really enjoyed them. I'm also really glad, as we saw that vision that she had from the migraine trigger, as we kind of saw that come together, we didn't live out the naked time from the prophecy. because I think that would not have fit into the story arc. But I wouldn't put it beyond a television show to try to stick that in, or a movie to try to stick that in and have her do like, oh, a big kissing scene with Beryl or whatever. I am so happy they didn't do that, because that would have taken me right out of the story. I would have been really annoyed. It would have just wrecked the whole thing. So I'm glad they didn't do it.
Well, it would have been a little cliched, wouldn't it?
It would have been a cliche. I don't know if it's coming later, but I suppose it could have been sort of a metaphoric naked, if she thinks about it, right? I mean, she clearly has feelings for Beryl, and she's kind of uncomfortable with them, because I think she looks at him as a religious leader and somebody to look up to. But at the same time, she's definitely got some attraction to him, because he kind of flirts with her in a weird, boring way. But, you know, maybe this vision was really about her sort of stripping herself, not physically, but stripping herself of whatever other things that she was stuck on, and standing up for Bajor in front of the ministers.
Interesting. That's a very interesting take.
Yeah.
What about with Dax and the sort of sense of humor?
I think this is the most we have really seen of Dax so far.
Yeah.
The character of Dax hasn't been developed very well. We had that one episode that was titled Dax, but she had very little part in it. And then we had Dramatis Personae, where she was the sort of airhead. Other than that, we haven't had a lot of Dax. It was really nice in this episode for them to develop her a bit. And she's got that sort of quirky sense of humor, like when she was asking how she looked with the Bajoran nose. But at the same time, she had that thing about she was sort of afraid of spiders or any insects. And she was mad in the shuttle as she hit her head. And she was like bashing on the door because it was broken. And she was really uncomfortable outside of the clean world of Starfleet. And in this world of the sort of rebel world that Kira was used to, she was really uncomfortable. So
she liked
ended up
technology.
With this sort of odd couple dynamic.
Yeah.
And I thought that was great. I'm happy to see any character developed. You know that. Anytime.
Yeah. They're really starting to round out this character and give us some more characteristics than we've seen in an entire season, really.
The women were just a normal part of the story. It didn't matter that they were female. It was great.
Right.
Just team
and the
members.
Bajoran military is clearly integrated.
That's true. And also, Vedic Wynn is a strong character, so I can't... even though she's scary.
She is definitely a woman on the dark side.
She is. But she's good. Okay, I think that's it for women in the future. How about rating? Thumbs up, thumbs down, or neutral? What is your rating?
Thumbs up for the final episode, and I think it was thumbs up for every one of these episodes. I thought it was a great story arc. It worked very well, and we saw all the things that I loved. Some special effects with the spacecraft. We saw Sisko delivering great speeches. Everything about this episode, I thought, worked well, and taking it as the final part of a three-parter, it was a very satisfying ending.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I also give it a thumbs up. That's three thumbs up in a row for this three-parter. I loved the teamwork aspect of it. That's the thing I have always loved about Star Trek. They came together to solve a problem. They couldn't all be in the same room. They all had to go off and do their own little missions in order to get there. And even within Deep Space Nine, they were split up into separate teams, but they still had to work together.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really impressed with Colonel Wings. He was, maybe it's because I don't like that actor that much, or I didn't like the show Wings. I don't know what it is, but I didn't like Colonel Wings very much, but he was a character who was needed.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's it for season 2, episode 3. Three excellent ones in a row. I think we have a lot to live up to now for the rest of the season, so hope episode 4 is as good.
That's only mildly concerning. I mean, this rest of the season has so much to live up to.
That's right.
Me, I'll pretty much like all of them anyway, but you're the one that needs to enjoy them.
For the first time, I really feel like I'm watching Star Trek.
Oh.
I think I only
really
had that feeling a couple of times in season 1, but these three definitely felt Star Trek-y to me.
So you're starting to see the appeal that the show had for me.
Yeah, but we have a long ways to go.
Still a Jiffy Lube.
It's still a Jiffy Lube. All right, come back next week for Season 2, Episode 4. In the meantime, if you'd like to tell us your own overanalysis of this or any episode, or if you just want to say something nice, please email us at rebingeit@gmail.com or tweet us at rebingeit. Also, check us out on talkthroughmedia.com. You can leave feedback for us there and listen to all of our other awesome podcasts.
Thanks for joining us on the Rebinge Deep Space Nine podcast.
That's it for me.
And that's it from me.